On va commencer. I think we'll get going. Bon après-midi à tout le monde. Good afternoon. My name is Will Straw. I'm the director of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, the hosts of this event. And I'd like to welcome you here for one of our most cherished annual events, the J.R. Mallory Lecture in Canadian Studies. And we're particularly pleased to have Cindy Blackstock, who will deliver a lecture entitled Reconciliation, the Children's Version. Now, I just want to begin by telling you a little bit about the Mallory, J.R. Mallory and the Mallory Lecture. J.R. Mallory was a professor of political science at McGill. He was born in 1916, almost 100 years ago, in St. Andrews, New Brunswick, was educated at New Brunswick, at Dalhousie, in Edinburgh, and his career took him to Saskatchewan, Toronto, Brandon, and McGill, where he served for 45 years, was chairman of the Economics and Political Science Department for 10 years, and then after retiring in 1982, was appointed professor emeritus and continued to teach for another 10 years. Professor Mallory passed away in 2003. Well, the endowment for this lecture was established in January 1995, and over the years, the lecture has featured such renowned speakers as Bob Ray, Alain Dubuc, Tom Kent, John Gomery, Chantal Hébert, Andrew Cohen, Noah Richler, Elizabeth May, and has been the tradition for so long, for so many years. We're very pleased to have among us today Professor Mallory's son, Charles, along with Charles's wife, Dorothy Levine. So welcome once again. Now, as an extra little treat, before Suzanne Morton introduces Cindy Blackstock, I'm going to ask the Dean of the Faculty of Arts, Christopher Manfredi, to come up and announce this year's three finalists for the Kundal Prize in Historical Literature at McGill, an event that the Institute helps to organize. So I hope you enjoy this year's lecture, and I'll ask Dean Manfredi to come to the podium.
Thank you very much, Will. It is, of course, a pleasure for me to be at the Mallory Lecture. It's great to see Charles and Dorothy again and to honor the memory of our former colleague, J.R. Mallory, who I had the pleasure of knowing during my first few years at McGill University. As Will mentioned, one of the things that the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada does for the Faculty of Arts is take care of the logistics for the Kundal Prize in Historical Literature at McGill. The Kundal Prize, if you're not familiar with it, is the world's largest non-fiction historical literature prize. There is a first prize of $75,000 and two Recognition of Excellence awards of $10,000 each. And the jury has been working hard over the summer, reading some 170 books before arriving at the finalist list. The winner of the prize will be announced on November 20th at a gala dinner in Toronto, but I'm pleased to be here this afternoon to announce the three finalists who were decided today during an in-person meeting of the jury in a remarkably efficient and non-confrontational meeting among the jurors. I confess that it has not always been that way every year. I used to tell my wife that the most stressful thing I do every year is preside over the deliberations of the Kundal Prize jury. Fortunately, it wasn't that way this year. But let me announce the three finalists, and you can look for more about them in the media in the days to come. I'm announcing them in alphabetical order by author, so you don't think that you have any clues about who might win. The first finalist is Gary Bass for his book, The Blood Telegram, Nixon, Kissinger, and a Forgotten Genocide, published by Knopf. The second finalist is Richard Overy for his book, The Bombing War, Europe 1939 to 1945, published by Alan Lane. And the third finalist is David von Rybrook for his book, Congo, The Epic History of a People, published by Fourth Estate. So each of those three individuals has, as they say, already won at least $10,000, and one of them will be the grand prize winner of $75,000 announced November 20th in Toronto. And I want to thank Will for letting me use this opportunity to unveil that shortlist. I'm sorry I can't be here for the entire lecture, Please look forward to more announcements about those three finalists in the days to come. Thank you very much.
Bonjour toutes et tous. My name is Suzanne Morton, and I'm a former acting director of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada. I'd like to welcome you all here to the J.R. Mallory Lecture in Canadian Studies. We're particularly pleased to have Dr. Cindy Blackstock with us this evening. I must say that one of the highlights of my 6 months on Peel Street was helping to put together this lecture, and we were absolutely thrilled when Dr. Blackstock accepted our invitation. A member of the Gitxsan Nation, Cindy Blackstock has worked in the field of child and family services for over 20 years and is a vocal advocate for Aboriginal children. She's the executive director of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society of Canada and an associate professor at the University of Alberta. She's also a McGill alumna. She earned her master's degree in management here, in addition to a BA in psychology at the University of British Columbia and a PhD in social work at the University of Toronto. Some of Dr. Blackstock's key interests include exploring the overrepresentation of Aboriginal child welfare care, structural drivers in the child maltreatment in First Nations community, and human rights and the role of the voluntary sector in expanding the range of culturally and community-based responses to child maltreatment. She has famously taken on the federal government regarding its lack of funding for Indigenous child welfare, filing a complaint with the Canadian Human Rights Commission in 2007, which remains before the courts. This has led her to being spied upon by the federal government, and she's become an outspoken advocate concerning issues of online privacy. An author of over 50 publications and widely sought after as a public speaker, Cindy Blackstock has collaborated with other Indigenous leaders to assist in the United Nations Committee on the Rights of the Child in the development of the adoption of a general comment on the rights of Indigenous children. She's also worked with Indigenous young people, UNICEF, and the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues to produce a youth-friendly version of the United Nations Declarations on the Rights of the Child. Dr. Blackstock is currently completing a Master of Jurisprudence in Child Law, Children's Law and Policy at Loyola University Chicago, and her current professional interests include serving as an Atkinson Economic Justice Fellow, a J.W. McConnell Family Foundation Social Innovation Generation Fellow, an Ashkora Fellow, and a board member of the National Aboriginal Youth Organization. She's recently voted one of 15 Aboriginal Heroes of 2014 by Muscat Magazine for her commitment to seeking justice for Indigenous children. I hope you enjoy this year's Mallory Lecture. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to present Dr. Cindy Blackstock.
So what a great honor to be here on Ganawage territory. There's lots of talk about reconciliation now. I have my own simple definition. It means not saying sorry twice. What really matters is how much we learn from the past and whether or not the Government of Canada has changed its relationship towards First Nations children to be one that all Canadians would be proud of, to be one that embodies senses of justice, to be one that represents equity, that to be one that understands and honors its traditional obligations to Indigenous peoples, and to be one that we don't have to apologize for in another 100 years. One of my dear friends and mentors is Justice Murray Sinclair. Of course, he is the Commissioner of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and what he has said recently, I think, really sums up what I'm about to talk about. He said in an article, when it comes to reconciliation, the truth will set you free, but first it will piss you off. And we need to be pissed off not only about what happened in the past, but as I'm going to tell you, we need to be pissed off enough about what's happening now to collectively call up the very best of what Canadian citizens are to create a new future for our country, which is one we can all feel proud of. But let's take a glance backward. This is one of the documents in my office. It's dated 1895. For those of you who've been to Ottawa and you've been to the Booth Building, that is where Duncan Campbell Scott worked from. It is a warrant for the removal of First Nations children and their placement in residential schools. And what many of you know is that they were removed for the purposes of education, which was really about assimilation. But one of the untold stories of residential schools is they were really the earliest form of child welfare, in that children were also removed because they were, quote, not properly cared for by government authorities, and they would be placed into the residential schools. And accompanying this warrant is a series of regulations that map out the legal procedure for these exercising of the warrant. And as I look at that, it's very similar to what we find in child welfare statutes today. Not much has changed from this earliest version of residential schools. Now, one of the issues that arose in residential schools, if you ever read John Molloy's great book, A National Crime, is that for decades, the government of Canada consciously underfunded those schools. And that resulted in the harms and deaths of children. For example, one of my heroes, Peter Henderson Bryce, a doctor that would have been around at the time of your father, he discovered that 24% of the children were dying in the schools every year as a result of preventable causes of disease. In 1922, he published a report called A National Crime, talking that Canada had failed to take the measures to save the lives of those children. Now, he has a quote in his report. It says, "Medical science knows just what to do." It knows just what to do in 1922 to save the lives of those children, and yet the government of Canada never did it. The government of Canada never did it. And Bryce published that report because he believed in the goodness of citizens. He thought people like you understood what was going on. You would be just as appalled as he was, and you would rise up and demand that the government of Canada did the right thing for those kids. Because after all, isn't that really the measure of a person and of a country? Don't we all say to ourselves, if we know better for kids, then we need to do better for kids? It's why we want better for our kids than we had for ourselves. And isn't just that a fundamental belief, an expectation, a minimal expectation we should have of our governments as well? Well, those inequalities, that underfunding that results in harms to children, echoes forward to our contemporary times. Despite the apology from the Prime Minister for residential schools, we are finding huge inequalities across all dimensions of First Nations children's services on reserve. And the reason for that is that provincial and territorial child welfare, education, and health laws have, in my view, wrongfully displaced traditional First Nations laws that used to govern those matters. But nonetheless, they apply. But the federal government funds those services on reserve, whereas the provinces and territories fund it for all other Canadians. And as Sheila Fraser and many auditors generals before her and since have found, the federal government routinely underfunds those services, and they use funding formulas that are really archaic and not responsive at all to the needs of children. So what you'll have is a two-tiered system of this underfunding. And this has persisted in the country, in my view, for a couple of reasons. One is that Canadians, unfortunately, are fed a steady diet of stereotypes about First Nations peoples that get in the way of them questioning some of these issues. For example, the issue that First Nations are all remote. They're too remote. You can't expect to get all these services if you're in a remote community, right? Now, do you ever notice, or is it just me, that only comes up when the government is talking about people and not when it's talking about uranium or oil or diamonds? And, you know, even when it talks about people, it's selective. I mean, after all, we had one astronaut up in a space station, and they put a live feed so that he could FaceTime and Twitter with people down here in Canada. No one said he's too remote. The next one is, it's too complex. Oh, Aboriginal people are too complex. We have to actually have a unit to relate to Aboriginal people. They're so special. Well, it comes a lot in water. 1 in 6 First Nations don't even have clean water to drink in this, one of the wealthiest countries in the world. But if there was an international crisis halfway around the world an earthquake or some other horrible thing, Canada would have a DART team pressing fresh water to those communities within 24 hours. So it's not complex. And the other one is money management. Now, I hate to raise it here in Montreal because I know it's a delicate matter with politicians and money management here at the moment. But what happens with First Nations is, yes, there are some people who are probably committing fraud who are First Nations. Yes, there are people who are poor money managers. But it's not a cultural characteristic. And when the federal government identified a couple of those minor instances, they passed the First Nations Accountability Act. Well, when are they going to get to the Montreal Municipal Act, right? So these things are things, though, and I know they sound silly when we raise them, but they really stop us, don't they, from thinking and piercing by that veneer into the inequalities that really offend the sensibilities of so many people. And why is equality a good idea for everyone? You hear First Nations saying, we need to address these problems and it'll be better for everyone. Well, if I was Prime Minister, and that's a long shot because I've never run for anything in elected office, but let's just say the miracle happened and I was, I would actually have all my efforts concentrated on reducing the inequalities in our own country. Because the best evidence says if I did that, I would be able to support people having longer lifespans, a more robust economy, less crime, less teenage pregnancy, less mental health issues. The best research in the world says that. Unfortunately, in Canada, the gap is getting rising, right? And yet we're coming upon election period next year. I get a full shot of it because I live right in Ottawa there. And regardless of what political party, they all have one message, which is vote for me because I'm going to give you a job. You're going to have a robust economy, and that means you're going to be able to look after your kids, right? I mean, I could be a politician. All I have to do is memorize that line. Now, it would be nice if that was true, but as I'm going to show you, I'm going to challenge you to think that it's not. This is Canada's world banking and economic power. According to the World Bank statistics, we are the 11th wealthiest country in the world. So if this idea of trickle-down economics actually worked, which we know has been discredited in economics and for many years, but it's still live political fodder, if it really was true, shouldn't children in Canada be ranking at about 11 or higher in the world? Wouldn't we think that, right? Well, let's take a look. When an international group called the Kids' Rights Foundation, which is one of the preeminent children's groups, by the way, they're the group that partners with the Nobel laureates every year to give out the International Children's Peace Prize. Malala won it last year, right? Very credible organization. They asked an important question. Proportionate to their wealth, how well are various countries doing in terms of their kids? One of the most striking results reported by this index is Canada. We rank overall score 60th in the world, 6-0 in the world. The economy is doing almost six times as better as this generation of children are. And this is all Canadian children. This doesn't parse out the more disadvantaged children in First Nations experience. And when you look at the sub-indexes, one of them is about creating a policy and legislative climate for children. In that index, Canada rates 115th in the world, only two spots away from the Russian Federation. So if I was a politician or a person in business, this would worry me a great deal. Because what we're doing is we're planting seeds for what Canada's economic and social and political future is going to look like. We are not climbing, we are actually sliding. And we're already seeing that in the Human Development Index, where Canada has quickly slid within a decade, slightly over a decade, from the best place in the world to live to number 11, and we're falling. So this is a problem for all of us. The best investment that any country can make is in kids. It's not in people my age. For every dollar you invest in a child, especially in your early years, it saves $7 down the line. So really, if I was a government, I would be heavily investing in children because that secures and sustains economic growth and a whole pile of other positive outcomes over time. And as you can see, we have a lot to worry about in this country. And we're certainly not in a position, no government, provincial, federal, or territorial, can legitimately rely on an evidence base to say we're doing everything we can economically for kids, not when we're 60th in the world. So what do these inequalities look like for kids today? Well, this is Jordan River Anderson. He was born in 1995 in Norway House Cree Nation to Ernest and Virginia Anderson. Now, he was born in Winnipeg Children's Hospital because he had complex medical needs. So for the first 2 years of his life, he had to stay in a hospital until doctors could stabilize his medical care. His mother stayed with him. His dad returned to the community to look after the other children and to work with the folks in the community to make sure everything was ready for when Jordan went home. So that day came shortly after Jordan's second birthday. And you can imagine, many of us in this audience have had sick children ourselves or had a sick relative in hospital. We know how difficult it is if they're in there for a period of time. But 2 years and a young baby, you can imagine how much the family was looking for that discharge day. And it finally came. Doctor said he could go home. They were happy with the plan. Except Jordan was a First Nations child. So the government of Manitoba said, well, if he was non-Aboriginal, we would pay for his at-home care. But because he's First Nations, he is a federal government responsibility. And the feds looked around all their departments and couldn't figure out who was responsible. So what they decided to do is leave this baby in the hospital while they argued over who should care for his care. He stayed there for over 2.5 years. 2.5 years. His physicians were writing letters to the government saying this child is not, it's not healthy for them to grow up in an institution. The family was trying. The First Nation was trying. It went into deaf ears in the process. And those close to Jordan say eventually he died of a broken heart. He slipped into a coma shortly after his fifth birthday, and he never lived again. His family asked that this never happen to another child, and we knew it was all over the country. So we worked with Jordan's family to create Jordan's principle, which is basically a fundamental principle of equality. It says, when a child, any child in Canada, has access to a government service, First Nations children should be able to access it on the same terms. No extra hoops, no payment issues coming before that. It passed unanimously in the House of Commons in December of 2012. I'll never forget that day. It was up in the gallery, and Ernest Anderson was over to my left. It was dark up there, and each one of the MPs would rise, and instead of sitting down as they voted, they all remained standing. And then they gave a standing ovation to Ernest Anderson and his family. But Ernest, he said, "Don't let the good being done in my son's name today just be a moral victory." He had not gone through all of that just to get a vote and an applause. He wanted to see real change in the lives of children. And so we've invited Caring Canadians to write in and support Jordan's principle, to join us in saying that this principle is so important. And it's become really critical, because shortly after it passed, the federal government began to narrow it very quickly. They said, no, 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 not to all children's services, only to services for children with complex medical needs and multiple service providers. And we're not going to tell you how to access a claim for Jordan's principle. So if you were a parent, you didn't know who to call or who to talk to. And then they said, these Jordan's principle cases will only occur if we say they occur. Needless to say, the federal government was saying, as recently as just a few months ago, in the last time since Jordan's principle has been passed, not one Jordan's principle case has arisen. But Maureen Abeedle would disagree. This is a courageous mother. She, if she was here, she wanted to tell you that her greatest honor in her life is being a mother. She's a proud Mi'kmaq woman. She's a single parent of two boys. And she would want to tell you that Jeremy, who's in the picture, is just one of those kids whose spirit comes alive when he's in the presence of music or art. What is also true is that Jeremy fits even within that very narrow definition that the government offered. He has cerebral palsy and a severe form of autism. Now, Marina cares for Jeremy with almost no services, and I think we can all agree as caring Canadians that services for persons with disabilities off reserve are appalling, really, for a rich country like ours. But on reserve, they're almost non-existent. But nonetheless, she cares for him. When Jeremy's 15 years of age, Marina suffers a double stroke, so severe she cannot hold a water glass. Her first thought is not for herself, it's who's going to look after Jeremy. Thankfully, they knew about Jordan's principle, so they go to the federal government saying this fits squarely within your definition. There's a Supreme Court of Nova Scotia decision off reserve that says that you have to provide whatever clinicians say is required until the parent can recover. Seems really clear. Well, the federal government says, no, no, no. We are not going by the Supreme Court of Nova Scotia decision. We're looking at the policy that was overturned by the Supreme Court of Nova Scotia. It says that families only get a fixed amount. So that's what Marina is going to get, is that fixed amount. They know it's insufficient for Jeremy's care. So in emails, Health Canada officials set out several options. They said, number one, Marina Beagle and their small First Nations community could fundraise to get the extra funds that Jeremy needs for his care. Number two, they could just accept this level of care, this fixed amount, which is inadequate for Jeremy's needs, and things would deteriorate in the family, and child welfare would intervene, and the government would pay for that. Or option three is they could place Jeremy in an institution at a far higher cost, by the way, to the taxpayer. Now, what would you do if you're Marina Beadle? You're a single mother, you just suffered a double stroke, you're caring for a high special needs child, and these options come at you. Well, this courageous mother took the federal government to court. She alleged that the failure to implement Jordan's principle was a breach of the charter. She said she brought that case not just for Jeremy, but for all families, and to honor Jordan's memory. And the federal court agreed. The federal court said that the government's implementation of Jordan's principle was unlawful, and they ordered the federal government to pay for Jeremy's services. Now, that should have been a good day for all Canadians and for Jordan's principle, but the federal government appealed. And who did they want to recover their legal fees from? Marina Beadle. They put her under that financial stress for over a year before, shortly before the federal court of appeal date, on a Friday afternoon at 4:30, which is when you have to watch for the government releasing bad news, by the way, especially on a long weekend. That's when the really bad news comes out. They withdrew their appeal. So this is actually a good court case. But the levels of discrimination these kids experience is just astounding. Now, I'm going to talk about this child welfare tribunal that came in the introduction in a moment. I want to show you a government document that was tabled at the tribunal. This is an internal document. This is where the government is explaining what cases are not Jordan's principle. Remember I said they narrowed them? So this is authored by Health Canada and Indian Affairs officials. And what it's pointing out is if you were a child with a disability and you required a wheelchair, a lift, and a stroller, off reserve you would get all of those things as medically required. On reserve, that First Nations child is going to get one of those items every 5 years, and the lift, well, you're going to have to install it yourself. It goes on to list other examples. Orthodontic care. If you are a child on reserve, you only get orthodontic care if you cannot eat or you cannot talk. That same document shows how the Government of Canada encourages that the children's teeth actually be pulled because it's cheaper. I talked to a dentist about this, and I think you could all agree that that's pretty barbaric. But that's not enough. You have to get pre-approval for these orthodontic services, and the government were saying that that is available. So let's look at the turnaround times for that. This is a presentation by the government, and they're identifying how long it takes for a pre-approval. And you can see there for a root canal, you'd only have to wait 40 days for the pre-approval. Or if you had, say you needed to go in under sedation, you'd be looking at pretty much a month for pre-approval. Now, put yourself back at that child. You're the parent of that child who cannot eat and cannot talk. How long can you wait for this process to kick in? Like, this is the 11th richest country in the world, right? And this is happening right now to families all over this country. But what about child welfare? Well, a lot of people are talking about residential schools, and we apologized. And for that, that was a good thing that we did that. I think it at least acknowledged what had happened in this country. And it allowed stories such as the survivors and some of the heroes, like P.H. Bryce, to be celebrated in a way that wasn't possible before. But there are more First Nations children in child welfare care today than there was at the height of residential schools by a factor of three. They are entering child welfare not for reasons of abuse, although that happens in our communities, and we need to courageously accept that, acknowledge it, and deal with it. I'm not an apologist for any form of abuse. But the best research done here at McGill by Nico Trockme and others is that it's for poverty, poor housing, and substance misuse related to mental health from multi-generational impacts of residential schools. All things we could do something about. Now, the problem with this word overrepresentation is it almost makes it comfortable to say, doesn't it? We can say that on average, First Nations children are 6 to 8 times more likely to end up in foster care for these reasons. It makes it kind of okay. And I can tell you that on reserve across the country, there's about 9,000 First Nations children in foster care. There's about 120 of you in this room right now. But what if you thought about it the way kids think about it? Which is, how many sleeps have they spent away from their family? One of the documents that literally took my breath away when I had to testify to it at the tribunal was a document by the federal government showing the number of nights First Nations children had spent in foster care between 1989 and 2012. And when I added it up, it was 66 million nights over 187,000 years of childhood that they'll never get back. Some of those kids need to be in child welfare care. I was a child protection worker myself for 13 years, but not at these overrepresentation rates, and not because they get 34% less funding for child welfare services than every other Canadian, according to the Government of Canada's own documents. So that's what led us to filing this complaint. I'm not a lawyer. I kind of just stumbled into this. And I'm actually pretty naive, because I really believed, like Bryce did, that if we were able to use evidence to show the inequality, and more importantly, not just complain, because I'm not just about pointing out problems with the government, that's easy, but actually involve yourself in developing evidence-based solutions to correct the problem, and they could do it, that they would do it. We did that twice. The second time, with over 20 leading experts, including 5 economists. The Government of Canada on both occasions agreed with the findings, was running a surplus budget, and yet walked away from it. In fact, one of the things that's a bit embarrassing for the government in the case is some of you will be lawyers or other people familiar with legal proceedings, and you can have expert witnesses, right? So the government hired the expert witness KPMG, the accounting firm, to try and discredit and refute our calculations of the shortfall. Well, KPMG did its report. It came within 0.12% of our calculations. Needless to say, we filed the KPMG report in support of our allegations, and the federal government never called KPMG after all. But this case is important. It was filed in 2007. It strikes at the conscience of the Canadian nation, doesn't it? I mean, who are we as a people if we choose to consciously racially discriminate against little kids in foster care, when we're the 11th richest economy in the world? And I filed that case. I was with National Chief Phil Fontaine. I still remember walking out of Parliament that day, and I could hear the echoes of my heels on the front steps of that house, because there was nobody there. I still remember seeing the people take pictures of the eternal flame and watching, hearing the wind of the flag behind me. It was easy to think that people like you just didn't care. Or maybe you thought we deserved it. Or look how generous we were being to them and they're still not grateful. But like Bryce, and like many others, I've always believed in the goodness of people, all people. And I believed if Canadians knew what was going on, they would be as outraged as I am. So we created a campaign called I Am a Witness. It doesn't ask you to take a side. It just asks you to watch. We put on all the Government of Canada's to court documents and all of ours. We put in all the reports by the Auditor General and by other experts, and we simply ask you to watch. Well, you can see that there are 13,363 people registered. Hopefully there will be more by the end of the evening. You can register to witness too. So how did we go from 0 to 13,000? Well, within 30 days of filing the complaint, we lost 100% of our funding from the federal government. That's what democracy looks like in this country. You can speak freely as long as they agree. And we had $50,000 in the bank. We're going up against the largest law firm in the country, the Department of Justice. So how do you deal with that? And an envelope arrived in the mail, and it had pencil crayon on the outside. You know what? I think the best letters are in pencil crayon on the outside. And so I took it to my office, and it shook, you know, like jingled as I walked. And I opened it up, and it said, "Dear Cindy, here's some M-U-N-Y for the kids. Love, Ella." And inside was $1.67 from her piggy bank. That's how we kept going. Is that children may not be experts in politics, but they are experts in love and fairness. And they can see when something's wrong. And not only do they want to fix it, they'll do something to fix it. So at the first hearings, I still remember sitting there alone for many of the court proceedings, but when we finally did get an audience, in come a group of teenagers. And as a young man said to me, "We are from alternate school, which means we get into trouble a lot." I said, "That's good, because so do I. I just, through the years, try to get into trouble for doing the right thing instead of what I used to get in trouble for." And I said, "Sometimes we deserve it. Yeah, we do. We do stupid things. But sometimes it's the stupid systems that deserve it, and almost nobody ever takes them on. And you are, and you want our help, and that's why we're here." So not only did they stay that first full set of hearings, they came back at the next set of hearings, and they brought friends, and they were wearing new attire. I Am a Witness t-shirts that they had designed. They said, "First Nations people will never be alone. We're going to be here with them." Now, you might wonder what teenagers would possibly get out of a court here, right? Well, if you were there, you would hear the government of Canada spending $3 million of your tax dollars trying to get off this case on two legal technicalities. First of all, they're saying, "It's unfair to us as the federal government to compare our level of funding to those of the provinces." Now, as a layperson, I'm thinking, I don't think I filed this case because of fairness issues for the federal government. It was about fairness for kids. But that doesn't make sense anyway, because the federal government requires First Nations to use provincial legislation. Then the second thing is, we, the funder, only fund the services. We have people in the communities delivering them. So if they're inequitable and discriminatory, it should be the social workers who are held accountable, not us as the funder. So the teenagers are listening to this. And then we have them write their reflections. Because I tell all the children, young people, I said, "I don't want you to agree with me just because of what I sound good and I look good. Or at least I try to look good most of the time. I want you to be like a newspaper reporter. That means you listen to all sides of the argument. You go on the internet, you talk to your family, you talk to other experts, and then you make up in your own heart and mind what you think you believe about this. And even when you think you know what you believe, you keep yourself open to new ideas and information coming forward, because that's what learning is all about." So that's what these teenagers were doing, and you can see Summer here. She's, at the time, 14 years old. And she says, "Canada's lawyer has to come up with a good reason as to why the tribunal should be dismissed. And really, there isn't any good reason except for the fact that the government is scared and doesn't want justice to be done. It's no wonder the government doesn't want this to be public. It's quite embarrassing and sad to think our government is trying to get out of its responsibility to provide the same quality of services to First Nations children in the child welfare system as they do to non-Native children." One of the young people was actually quite skeptical. And she wrote in her thing, she said, "Well, I heard the First Nations side of the story. So I came to these hearings wanting to hear the other side of the story. There's got to be a reasonable explanation for this." And so after 2 days, she came up and she said, "There is no other side of the story." Now, they decided they would go and bring their younger brothers and sisters. And this is 2012. There's another one of Canada's efforts to get the case dismissed. We're now having so many children come to the hearing that we have to book them in shifts, and we had to move the hearings all over to the Supreme Court of Canada. Now, I remember the security guard that day. He said, "It's like a daycare in here. All these yellow school buses are pulling up to the front of the Supreme Court. All these kids are in there." Now, imagine yourself as the government of Canada. And you look back and you see people like yourselves in the jury row, in the rows of the people watching. How would that make you feel? Versus turning around and seeing them. Who would have more of a powerful impact on you? Now, your only hope is that they do not understand a word of this legal gobbledygook that's being spit out. But these kids, they've done their homework. And I come out at halftime. And the thing is, when you're working with children, I would say in terms of civic action, not only create critical thinkers, but the second thing is plan around nap time and snack time, right? They need their breaks. So they're out there having their snack time. And I see this one boy wave me over. He says, "We're over here." So I go over. And first of all, he wanted to tell me. He said, "Look, see those bathrooms? There's marble in there. This is a very fancy place." And there was. Then he ripped out a sheet of paper. And you know the scores, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, big long list on one side and a short list on the other. And I said, "Well, what's this all about?" And he said, "Well, Cindy, you know, we came here to listen to the government people, like you told us to. And so I've been keeping score. The long list is when the judge asked the Canada people a question, and the short list is when they answered." They said, "If it really is a case about kids, then why aren't they talking about what's best for kids? Things that kids care about." One of the 12-year-olds who came, she said, "When I play girls' hockey, my coach tells me to play for the team on the front of the sweater, not the name on the back." And she said, "Kids, we don't know what conservative means or liberal means or new Democrat means, but we know what fairness means. We like clean water. We like to have enough good food to eat, and we like somewhere to go to bed, and we like a good school. So why are the people who are running the country, why are they playing for the name on the back of the sweater instead of for all of Canada's children who are on the front?" I think sometimes kids just tell it how it is. They stop making excuses for us. And unfortunately, we raise children to kind of learn to absorb these excuses. And we call it politeness, which I think is a mistake. Here's the Government of Canada's own document showing the inequality. This was filed at the tribunal. So you can see there they think they're short funding by about $500 million. And this was dated 2012. There's other PowerPoints very similar to this. This is done by the Regional Director General. So that's one level below the Assistant Deputy Minister. The presentation, I believe, in this instance, is being made to the Assistant Deputy Minister. There's numerous documents like this. And where there's overspending, even though they're underfunding child welfare, because they're underfunding prevention services to keep kids safely in their homes, more and more kids are going into child welfare care unnecessarily. So to cover those costs, they're not going to Treasury Board. They're actually taking money from the fund to fund First Nations schools, water, housing and infrastructure. And I said to the tribunal, this is like shuffling deck chairs on the Titanic, because one of the leading drivers for kids going into care is poor housing. And as you can see, the level of reallocation is significant. And as you can also see from the government's own presentation, it's not because they have a lot of money there that's going nowhere. They're actually severely underfunding these other areas. So they're trying to remedy discrimination by creating discrimination, which is fundamentally wrong. Now, how would they explain that? Well, these are their reply submissions. We were all waiting to see what the government would say in its final written submissions. And you can see here that they explain all these government documents as being personal views of their employees. That's the best they can come up with. Now, some of these personal views were made by the deputy minister, by the assistant deputy minister, by regional directors, and so on down the line. But this was just filed last week, so you can actually go read the full document on fnwitness.ca. And what about that nuisance of an Auditor General's report? That's what the Auditor General found in 2008. This was Sheila Fraser at the time. You can see the department agrees with her recommendations and findings that their funding formulas are not only outdated, that they lead to funding inequities. But to address this problem, The federal government is saying, Don't place any weight on these. Place minimal weight, because the complainants, that being the Caring Society and AFN, the Canadian Human Rights Commission, who I want to give a great shout out to because they've been so supportive in this case. They're acting in the public interest, but they are, I think, fair enough to say they are advocating for equality for kids. And you can see there, they're saying, don't pay any attention because they didn't call the Auditor General. What they don't say is it's impossible to call the Auditor General. The Auditor General's Act specifically forbids you from calling the Auditor General as a witness. She could not even testify willingly in these proceedings. So you can see, with their expert report actually confirming our findings, with them having only this defense that their personal views of their employees, and this idea that we should place minimal weight on the Auditor General, that this is not the strongest case from the federal government side. But what you need to say, no, as citizens of this country, is they're fighting to keep things the way they are. They are using your tax dollars, representing you in that courtroom, saying, this is the type of government and future you want for your country. And I don't believe that's true. I guess I'm like Bethany. I think regardless of whether you're in the federal government as a conservative, as an NDP, as a Democrat, or a Green Party member, at the fun end of the day, everybody believes in fairness for kids. Now, the closing arguments are next week, and there will be live webcast, and you can go on to fnwitness.ca and watch them for yourselves as you're being your own active witnesses. Because just as I would tell the kids, I don't want you to believe just what I'm saying. I want you to care enough to watch. And if you disagree, if that is raised in you, this, it can't be true, she's got to be wrong, I even want you more to watch. And I want you to try to prove me wrong. I want you to try to prove me wrong. And if you prove me wrong, you're going to prove the Auditor General wrong and the United Nations Committee on the Rights of the Child. And you can watch the case on FN Witness and use that Twitter hashtag. And those, by the way, are our mascots. That big bear, he's been at every single hearing. And I turn him around so that he sees everything. He's been to the Supreme Court. He's been held by all the kids. And this is his new outfit made by Cedar Gifts in Manitoba. So he's all dressed up for the big day. But when the court case crossed the 7-year mark, I thought it was time for a new generation. So you can see her. She's on the right. And I actually took her over to the Attorney General, and I said, you are in trouble if I have to buy a third bear. The kids, well, they'll be there. You watch on Monday, you'll see them in the audience. And not only are they going to be there, they've written their own journal. You know, who wants to read these blasé academic journals anyway, right? So the kids decide to take matters in their own hands, and they've written their letters and artworks and poetry about reconciliation and equity and the type of country that they want to grow up in. And it was all peer-reviewed by kids. So this Thursday, you can actually read the Children's Journal on Reconciliation. And they're not only going to tell you about what reconciliation means to them, they're going to show you how to do it. You know, if Wesley Prankard, one of my great heroes, was here today, he would tell you that it's not enough to know and it's not enough to care. Change only happens when you do something. And he's one of the best examples of that. You see, when he found out that First Nations children often don't have safe places to play, he decided he would pitch a tent in his local campground and ask people to pledge money for however long they were there so he could build playgrounds for First Nations communities. Well, he's cute. He's got a Facebook page, so he got earned $5,000. But he didn't give up there. He went to the corporate world and he asked them to match dollar for dollar what he had, because he found out that these playgrounds in these remote communities cost as much as $90,000. And the corporations agreed to price match until the kid won $25,000 in Pepsi Refresh. But the corporations, they kept their word. And so it was that Wesley's not only built one playground, but he's on his way to building others. And he said, you know, he calls his organization northernstarfish.org. I hope all of you will consider it for donation at your time of the year. But he calls it Northern Starfish, and I am a BC girl, so I actually know we have starfish in the Pacific Ocean. There are no starfish in the Arctic Ocean. That might change thanks to global warming, but not right now. So I asked him why that is, and he said, well, Cindy, it's because a lot of people told me it couldn't happen. You know, maybe in that way Wesley and I are alike. I believe with Wesley that only the impossible really is worth doing. You know, because it's the impossible questions that really catch us up in our humanity. And he said when he was dreaming of doing this, adults would come by and tell him it wasn't possible, and he was getting upset. So his dad told him a story, and some of you know it. It's where a little boy walks up to a beach and there's all these starfish washed up. And he can't help himself. He does what children do. They don't strike a logic model or committee. They don't wring their hands with worry. They do something. So he was picking them up and throwing them back into the ocean one by one so that they might live. And then along comes a gentleman, but it could have well been a woman, who said, what are you doing? Stand up. Take a look at all these starfish. There's no way you're going to save them all. Don't you have soccer practice or something? And he looked at them and said, man, there sure was a lot. And he was small and he was only a kid. But you know what, kids? Children have a wonderful, wonderful gift that's embedded in every single one of them. It's called disobedience. Sadly, we train it out of them too often. But despite himself and despite the logic of the man who stood before him, he found his knees bending. He picked up a starfish, he threw it into the ocean, and he said, there, I just saved that one. Wesley says to Canadians, this is not about charity. This is about social justice. And it's about ensuring that this is a country you'd be proud to raise your kids in. So on Monday, watch. And then on Tuesday, do something about it. Thank you very much.
This isn't even the official thank you, which will come in a few minutes. So. Well, before I ask my colleague to officially thank Dr. Blackstock, she has very kindly agreed to take some questions. So I would ask you, if you want to say something, come to the microphone. Please make it a question. Please make it as brief as possible. And we'll see how it goes.
And of course, the best way to thank me is to sign up for Jordan's Principle and go on to fnwitness.ca. They're all actually on our website. There's 7 free ways for every Canadian to make a difference. We at the Caring Society, like many charities, are really strapped for cash. But we absolutely don't create any of our campaigns around money. You won't find us out there walking the streets asking you for a donation, because we believe in the ability of every person, regardless of income, to be joining us on this process of creating a better country and rectifying these problems. So everything that we do is for free. And that's allowed us a great gift of having so many caring people of all levels of income, of all cultures and diversity, be a part of our thing. So check out the 7 free ways.
So thank you so much, eh? I'm wondering, depending on what happens then with the human rights outcome, if it works positively, where will things go? And if it rules against, where do you imagine the next direction being?
Well, I'm already working with the kids. When the kids come to the hearing, they always have one question for me. Cindy, when is the party that we're going to have when we win? So I don't think losing is an option. I really feel, on the basis of the evidence, it's pretty compelling. If the tribunal finds that there is racial discrimination against First Nations children, they have the authority to order a binding remedy. We've spelled out that remedy in our factum, the closing arguments, which you can find on fnwitness.ca. We're not asking for any money for the Caring Society. It's all to go to the children and their families so that we can rectify this problem. And we're asking the tribunal to maintain supervision because, sadly, Canada has a long history of this conduct, and we feel it needs to be under independent supervision while it implements the measure. And we also are asking that there be an independent body created to ensure the government of Canada across all areas of children's experience deal with equality and culturally-based services. If we win, they can appeal, and they probably will. What you'll probably find on the day of the judgment is we're having the decision under review. They'll wait for the news to die down, and then they'll file their appeal. But we are, and I am so thankful to the Canadian Human Rights Commission, to the lawyers at AFN, and to our own volunteer legal team headed by Sebastian Grimond and Robert Grant, because when they took on our case, they said, we only ask one thing. If you're happy with our services for the children, will you please let us take this to the Supreme Court of Canada without cost to you? So we will meet them at every level because we understand that caring Canadians and First Nations kids, they're depending on us not to give up, and we're not going to do it.
Well, that was quite a standing ovation, well-deserved. I remember when Phil Fontaine used to come to mining conventions, when he was head of AFM,
right,
and he'd tell us that 25% of the schools' roofs are leaking.
Yeah.
And it was just the beginning of what he's going to say. My question is about Lester B. Pearson's daughter. She was talking about the Bill of Rights about 25 years ago. I think I got the right person. And I remember her coming to McGill. And then all of a sudden there was a dearth of information until you came along, or others like yourself. That goes back quite a few years, and she was talking in the same tone as you were. But you know, being the Prime Minister's daughter, she thinks she would have had some pull, but it never worked out.
No, and I think that's really the important piece. I've learned that reconciliation is messy, and it also takes far too long. But with more and more voices, like those people, not only that you're speaking about that lady, but the First Nations folks and the people like Peter Henderson Bryce 100 years ago, every person who speaks out against us and calls it what it is puts down a footprint for those of us to follow. And what I have been so honored to do is I realize that any success that we've had has been because of those people who have come before us and spoken. And I'm hoping and I'm counting on each of you to go out and share what you saw tonight and to tell four or five other people. Because it's only when the government of Canada is told that it needs to change by caring Canadians like you that it actually will. Because governments do not, as I was told and taught by a maintenance worker outside Mahatma Gandhi's house in India, he said, governments do not create change, they respond to change. And that's why on these intractable problems, the conversation is not with the government. It's with the caring people who can tell the government what to do. And you get your chance next October.
I'm a student in social work at McGill, and I wanted to know what would be the best advice that you would give me, because I consider eventually maybe working with Aboriginal people, and I'm not Aboriginal, so what would be the best advice?
I'm going to tell you a story. I'm a First Nations person. I grew up in the bush. I didn't grow up on reserve. And when this job came open for this national director of the Caring Society, a lot of my colleagues around the country were giving me the nudge to apply. But I didn't the first time. I thought there was somebody else out there much more qualified than me to take the job. And so they paneled, they didn't find anybody. So then they nudged me again, said, get out of the job. I thought, my God, there are 50 different languages in this First Nations language, all these different cultures. How am I possibly going to be able to work with these people? And so anyway, I took the job, and I was coming down a meeting from Indian Affairs. Stressful meeting with Indian Affairs. But I had two people with me, one of which was an elder, Joan Glode from the Mi'kmaq Nation. And Joan comes down the elevator. She says, you know, after that, we really should go over to the prayer room. And I thought, that sounds like a pretty darn good idea to me. So we all go over there, and I'm feeling pretty confident because I know what to do in a First Nations prayer. So I've got it all lined up there. And I'm doing exactly what I shouldn't be doing. I should be in the moment, right? But I am breaking every single protocol, and I am just worried about the way I'm looking like. So there are three of us in a line, and there's an elder, and I'm feeling good about this. I know what to do until the elder picks up a basket of stones. Now, being the kind and generous and principled person I am, I'm hoping that they go to one of the other ladies first, and then I'll know what to do, and by the time she gets to me, I'll actually do the right thing. But the elder was like a cat with somebody with allergies. They're called wise for a reason. She comes right on over to me. And as you can see, I'm not the most relaxed type B kind of gal in the world. So I'm standing there and the elder's standing across from me. And she's got the basket of stones. And I say, okay, regroup, regroup. Remember the teachings, just be in the moment. So I kind of just closed my eyes down sideways. And then after what seemed like 700 years, I look up and she's still smiling at me with the basket of stones. So I managed to regroup. I put myself back and I look up and there she is, still smiling. So I figured, well, I got to go in for the kill here. I jump in and I grab a stone from her basket. Completely wrong, I hear or realize right away. But again, because of my principled stance, my next thought is, I hope Joan the Elder makes the same mistake, and then I'll be in good company. So there she is next to Joan the Elder. And it seems pretty clear to me after not too long that Joan doesn't know what to do either. So I'm feeling better about my situation. And I can see the elder looking back at Joan and Joan looking back. And then I'm wondering if she's going to dive into the basket and get a stone like I did. And then I hear Joan said, I want to be respectful. Can you please guide me? That's all you need to remember. I want to be respectful. Please guide me. If you say that, and I've done that all over the world with indigenous cultures since then. And by the way, that stone, I keep it in my office. And I look at it on a pretty regular basis. Especially when I'm thinking too good for my britches, it kind of brings me down a few notches. So I would say go in with a good heart, go in with respect, and you're going to have a wonderful experience. I have been so blessed to work with Indigenous and non-Indigenous people all over the world. And with that attitude of respect, you can take you anywhere. I hope that helps. You can have my stone one day if you want.
Hi. I just want to say thank you so much for all of the work that you do. It's absolutely incredible. And I've read some of your and Nico Chokmi's work on, you know, kind of the root causes of why there's an increasing number of First Nations children in foster care. And this is kind of a speculative question, but I was wondering, like, do you foresee positive repercussions, you know, assuming that the tribunal goes through and it's ruled in your favor, do you see positive repercussions and the government starting to address kind of the root causes and the poverty and the housing issues, if only just to save money? Now that they have to, like, you know, provide the same kind of funding?
Well, I'm hoping. I mean, there's a couple of optimistic things. Number one is there are really good examples of programs that work. One is the Family Unification Program in the United States. What the U.S. government did is they provided $15 million, which is nothing in the U.S. economy, but nonetheless they did it. And they gave it to child protection workers to provide housing vouchers for families coming to the attention of child protection in the amount up to $14,000. So imagine this is a child protection worker. You could actually pay for first and last month's rent. You could buy a washer and dryer for a single mom of four kids and diapers, right? What did they find with that $15 million investment? They saved 7,500 kids from going into foster care and saved the U.S. taxpayer $141 million. So they're good examples of programs that work out there. The other thing that's starting to happen is if you watch the Council of the Federation, which is the meeting that happens annually of all the premiers, they have prioritized the overrepresentation of First Nations children in child welfare care. So that's good, and hopefully with the tribunal ruling, and if we all collectively push them to ensure that they're not just doing window dressing, that they actually are getting at those factors that disadvantage families, then I think we really could be at that point of hope where that kind of positive change happens. Welcome. I think we're done. So that all, and you're all free to go, except if you're not convinced to sign up for the I Am a Witness campaign. If you're not, you need to stay here. And I can talk for a long time.
And I'd like to call on Dr. Alan Downey, who is the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada's Indigenous Studies postdoctoral fellow, to say some final words.
One more formal thank you coming. But thank you so much for this powerful lecture and this call to action, much needed. So thank you for that. My name is Alan Downey, as mentioned. I'm the new academic associate at the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada as part of McGill's new Indigenous Studies program. It's just being launched. And I'm also here to give you just the formal thank yous, but I'd like to take the opportunity to thank the Mallory family. Their continued support of the J.R. Mallory Lecture Series has hosted some of the most marvelous speakers we've ever seen at McGill, from the Honorable Marlene Jennings to Elizabeth May and the Official Language Commissioner of Graham Fraser, among others. So thank you very much for that. And having just witnessed such a powerful and moving lecture on Indigenous peoples, I also think it's fitting to thank those who've created the Indigenous Studies program. Within Canada, there's this growing momentum, and we can see it and we can feel it, but there's this momentum to change the relationship between Indigenous Canadians and Canadians. And I think the new program, the Indigenous Studies program, is a result of that. You see, unlike most programs where it's the professors leading the charge, it was actually the students that did it for the Indigenous Studies program. And many of them are actually sitting in this room. I've seen them. I know the students, MISC, and the First Peoples House have all been working tirelessly to create this program and see its success. And thank you very much for that. Beyond the launch of the Indigenous Studies program, it's been a really exciting year for MISC. Not only did we celebrate the 20th anniversary of the Institute this fall, we're also hosting the Montreal launch of three books November 4th. It's going to take place right here at the Faculty Club, and it's with authors Danielle Metcalf-Shinai and Michael and Gordon Derrick. That will be, again, taking place here. But don't forget about the February 19th and 20th MISC annual conference held each year. And this theme, the theme this year being the cities we need in Canada. Once again, Dr. Blackstock, thank you very much for coming to join us today. It is my honor to thank you on behalf of MISC for joining us. And I want to give you this small gift.
And a huge congratulations for them for the Indigenous Studies program, right? You know?